Hello, and welcome to Unfrozen. I'm Dan Safarik.
And I'm Greg Lindsay, and our guest today is Michael Eliason, founder of Larch Lab, and perhaps known and beloved to many for his epic Twitter threads of incredible mixed-use Baugruppen and other incredible forms of housing across Europe with the plaintive plea of why can't we build that here? And to discuss with us today exactly why we can't build that here, let's welcome Mike out onto the podcast. Mr. Eliason, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Greg. Daniel. Actually, Greg, it's Eliason. I don't know if there's a way to edit that in later.
Well, you know, just mangling people's names is what I do later. So, you know, maybe we will. Maybe we'll just leave it there to embarrass me. But thank you, Mike. I never had the chance to say it before. But yeah, it's a pleasure to have you on. I mean, basically, we want to catch up with you on like what Larch Lab has been up to, your own sort of expansion to other media ventures as well, and yeah, our sort of general discussion here. It's fire season. It's hurricane season. We love having you on to also talk about the effects of climate change as well. And so, where shall we start? I guess let's start with what are you up to these days.
So these days, I started Larch Lab a year ago. We're a architecture and urbanism studio / think and do tank. Started out doing a little bit of policy and research around point access blocks, single stair buildings. These are kind of the prototypical urban development in all of the world outside of the US and Canada. Been busy doing a lot of small projects. In the meantime, I have a couple of small development projects that I'm working on, talking to a couple of people about doing some mass timber buildings. And then looks like we finally have a path forward on our Baugruppe. So hopefully in the next year, we will be kicking off with that.
All right, well, let's delve into that one. First, for listeners who aren't familiar, although perhaps most will be, what is Baugruppen? And second, yeah, tell me how you're building your own, because that requires quite the coordination.
Yeah, so a Baugruppe, basically, it's self-developed urban housing. You can think of it as co-housing. It generally doesn't tend to have kind of the same granola aspects. I also think of co-housing in the U.S. as more of a suburban kind of form of living rather than urban. It's groups that come together and self-develop their own home. You know, so you can have family-friendly housing, multi-generational housing. Because you're the developer, you can kind of say, look, this, we're going to prioritize certain things. So you can prioritize, you know, low-carbon living, car-free living, building a passive house, building with mass timber, building car-free, things like that. And so our ultimate aim is to be able to do this here in Seattle. It's something that's existed in Germany for a little over 20 years now. It's not the predominant form of development. It's more just, it's kind of one more tool, right, that people can use to stay in the city, to dwell in the city. And so our aim is to do this here in Seattle. The way that we're going to end up doing this is going to be a little bit more streamlined than I think you would see in a typical German project. Normally, you know, everyone would kind of come together and co-design it. Because of the process of development in Seattle taking so long, entitlements, everything else. What we're planning on doing, and this is my buddy Aaron Yankowskis, who runs Black Sheep Development Company, and myself and a couple of others, we're kind of going to front end the building. We're going to have a general massing. We've got the site figured out. We have the finances 95% of the way figured out. And so it's, you know, we're going to get that building to a certain point, and then we'll open it up to the public. And we're still having some internal discussions about you know, who are we trying to get into this building? Is this an opportunity to reverse gentrification? Is there a way to get more affordable housing into this building? You know, we don't want to be all, you know, kind of middle and upper class white households. So what can we do to kind of, you know, to broaden that a little bit? And, you know, there'll be an opportunity to kind of tailor and fine tune some of the units at that point as well. And so really that's kind of the direction that we're going in. We think that there's going to be quite a bit of demand for something like this, you know, housing in Seattle and other U.S. cities. Well, I guess it's across all of the U.S. now at this point, right? Like there's a massive housing shortage. Millennials have little chance of home ownership in many cities. The rents are too damn high. And so, you know, we're not viewing ourselves as a panacea, but we do like to think that, you know, kind of in the same vein as cooperatives or community land trusts, you know, this is something, especially with support from the state or city level, that could really start to take off.
All right. Well, I would keep in this vein for a second here, because I think there's two aspects of this are particularly interesting to me. Number one is, of course, like what is your financing mechanism for this? Because everyone's pooling it together, because that holds a lot back. And then second, how's it actually going to work architecturally in terms of like designing the building together? I mean, you know, how are you also going to resist against designing it by committee, which is one of those things I always wonder about Baugruppen and even the European variants.
Yeah, so I'll touch on the design side first, because my buddy Aaron is doing most of the financial aspect, and he can talk about that much better than I can. So the design side, it's really just going to be a small apartment building. We're still kind of running through the numbers. We're definitely going to be aiming for passive house. There's this aspect of climate adaptation in a passive house that I think it should be the baseline for every building. You know, it's airtight. It's got a heat recovery ventilator. Here in the Northwest, we now have wildfire smoke season. And so those, you know, the airtightness and the HRV, which is filtered, but providing fresh air, right? Those work to keep smoke, a wildfire smoke out of the unit. You know, the extra insulation and, you know, the other methods of how we design those buildings, how we plan them, keep the heat out in the summer, keep the heat in the winter. And so there's really kind of this ingrained notion in our building that, you know, passive survivability will be a big component of it. We're aiming to be car free, although we imagine that there'll be a shared car that, you know, everyone will have access to. Would like to have a huge bike barn or bike room as a component of it. You know, our family is car free. We have way too many bikes and a couple of cargo bikes, and so we definitely need the room for that. Looking at it's going to be a small scale building. This is kind of our first attempt, so probably four floors at most, maybe five, depending on kind of if the zoning can change a little bit. And really 2 to 3 units max per floor. So it's a relatively small building. You know, we're not going to consume all of the lot. We're going to consume about half of the lot in terms of the footprint. And that'll leave kind of open space for people, garden, maybe a petanque court, you know, just spaces for people to kind of hang out around the house. And then, you know, units will, you know, be modern and efficient and, you know, have private outdoor space, balconies and whatnot. So it's, you know, it's going to be kind of this, it's not stripped back, right? Like it's, I think, more of a minimal, eco-minimal kind of way of living. On the finance side, so really this first one is going to be difficult. We were hoping that we could get some social impact investors to help on the front end, but we're basically just having to pull all of our resources together and really just see what we can scrap by. So in that sense, it's closer to how typical development would be done in Seattle in the U.S., but after trying this on and off for so long, talking to financial institutions, they understand the reasons and how it works. But, you know, banks weren't necessarily open to funding a project like this because we're not professional developers, right? And so we're, I guess, I'm trying to think of how to put this. You know, so we're kind of taking a more traditional approach to how you would do development. We're just trying to make a better product.
I wanted to ask a little bit, I'm going to nerd out for a second on the mass timber aspect, if you don't mind. So here at the Council on Tall Buildings and Urban Habitat, we have been lowering our threshold for what we consider to be a tall building or what we normally pay attention to, let's put it that way, because of this rising interest in mass timber. I was curious about, what type of construction technique you're using. I know there's a couple hybrid versions of mass timber that are popular out there, especially in high seismic regions. And then how do you reconcile the fact that, you know, the big play for, you know, timber is that it's, you know, carbon sequestration and it's saving embodied carbon. But passive house, the whole point is to, you know, limit the expenditure of operational carbon. Are those cross purposes, and how do you reconcile them?
So I'll start on the embodied and operational carbon first. I think that they're complementary. They're not in competition at all. It's true that when you make a building more efficient, the embodied carbon starts to take on a higher percentage of the overall carbon of the building. So by attempting to decarbonize our building, you know, we'll be fossil fuel free, no underground parking, you know, no high embodied carbon materials. We'd love to do mass timber CLT, you know, that's kind of still a little bit up in the air. But it's really, I think, just, you know, it's going to be wood-based and wood has a, you know, here in the Pacific Northwest, it's readily available. You know, we can get it FSC certified and sourced. You know, there are a lot of opportunities around that aspect of it that I think will be fine. In terms of the system for mass timber, it's a low building. It's basically a low-rise building. So It's difficult to get away from wood framed walls, and it's also difficult to compete economically. Like, we couldn't do an entire building out of CLT with wood framed walls. I'm not a huge fan of CLT for a number of reasons. It tends to be a lot of wood for the span, and there are more efficient, manners, there are more efficient products. The value added wood industry in the EU is, you know, CLT was 20 years ago. They're moving on to bigger and better things. And there are all of these kind of component based systems now that, just as an architect, A, blow my mind, and B, just it frustrates me because we don't really have access to a lot of this. I'd really love to do DLT. There's only a couple of manufacturers in North America that do DLT. That's the Dowell laminated timber. So CLT is, it's kind of like plywood on steroids, right? There's two bys laid flat, glue applied over it. Two bys laid in the opposite direction, glue over that. Two bys laid in the opposite direction again. And then it's all compressed. DLT is two by sixes or two by eights all laid on end. And then they drill these holes in them, and then they'll friction fit these hardwood dowels into the holes. And so it's just kind of this solid wood element. There's no glues. There's no metal. It looks so much better. I worked on the first DLT project here in Washington State a couple of years ago before I moved to Germany. And when I was working in Germany in Freiburg in 2003, 2004, the firm that I worked with used dowel laminated timber extensively. And so it's kind of been in the back of my mind for, I guess, 20 years now, right? And it's, you know, to me, like, it's a really beautiful product. It's really elegant. And hopefully we can find a more cost-effective ways to utilize it here in the U.S.
Yeah, we're hoping that some of the componentized systems do start to show their faces around here. They've even been constructed in places like Singapore, which you wouldn't even think of as being a big market for mass timber, but somehow the Austrian systems have found their way all the way over to Asia and Australia. Not so much here.
Yeah, there are a couple of, I think it's Ascent used, some of their timber was from Austria. But yeah, the Australians have been importing a lot of systems, components-based or modular systems from Austria. You know, frankly, I wish that we didn't have to ship these things, you know, halfway around the world, all the way around the world. The technology really should be transferable to other countries. And so, you know, the carbon footprint of shipping isn't that massive, but, you know, if we're doing a low carbon building, surely there are ways to reduce that carbon even more by, you know, keeping it local. And then there's all of the stories, you know, around, you know, revamping, you know, rural America, rural jobs. It's kind of synthesizing more of the, you know, the workforce and labor force, I guess, between the, you know, U.S. cities and rural areas, U.S. forests. You know, there's a lot of really elegant stories that can be played around that. And if we're importing products from Austria, we're kind of bypassing, you know, all of those stories.
Right. I mean, I think the challenge is just to build up the supply chain capability here, you know, on this continent. I think the areas that, you know, our big timber producing areas could certainly use it, and they just need to sort of get educated about it and have the political will to kind of allow that to happen. You know, including the Southeast, you know, where Southern Yellow Pine is being used. You know, there's a new factory that's just started up from Structure Lam in Rogers, Arkansas, to build. Well, you can guess who they're building for if it's in Arkansas. And you know, it's kind of you have Walmart there, which is, you know, not exactly the best global citizen when it comes to sustainability, but trying to make it a charge into that market. But I do think, you know, as a result of that impetus, much as, you know, Starbucks, you know, raised the bar for coffee generally so that a bunch of independent coffee shops could actually come up, you know, maybe the Walmart will have the same effect on mass timber production for, you know, smaller housing units and smaller office developments like the ones you're talking about.
Yeah, and you've definitely seen, like, the Silicon Valley has taken a keen interest in mass timber as well. You know, a lot of their new workspaces and additions and stuff. Here at Microsoft, it's the same thing, right? They're utilizing mass timber on all of these projects. It'll be interesting to see, you know, if beyond this first cycle they keep doing it, and if it expands beyond that. But, you know, there are some just massive projects here that are incorporating mass timber for, you know, commercial uses.
Yeah, I think it has a bright future. I think that the harder part is changing the overall development model, you know, in this country that results in a lot of just utter junk being created, or, you know, buildings that, as you point out in your podcast from the, I think it was September the 16th, talking about, you know, the single loaded versus double loaded corridors phenomenon, just all the rules around fire exiting and all the rules around the size of stairs and the width of stairs dictate so much about what developers are able to get financed and what they're willing to do, including the height of mass timber, which, you know, we just recently raised the roof on that. But it's, you know, it's frustrating to see that these, I wouldn't even call these technologies, but just these methodologies that have been so prevalent and successful around the world, take such a long time to get realized here.
Yeah, it takes a long time to get realized here. And I think that the, just in general, how we do development in the US, it's not high quality. It's not super livable. It's really expensive for what it is. And, you know, if, I talk about this a lot on Twitter, you know, the projects in Austria or Munich or Paris that are built with mass timber, that are built to or close to passive house standards, right? So no vinyl windows. These are wood windows, aluminum wood windows, and high quality buildings. Right, they're coming in with a construction cost that's, you know, less than $200,000 per unit. I saw recently San Francisco affordable housing hits up to $1 million per unit. There's a number of reasons for, around that, including wraparound services and other issues. But even here in Seattle, right, $200,000 a unit is still, for like a family sized unit, is still, you know, less than half of what it would cost here for a code minimum building. And that's not passive house. That's not mass timber. They're not, you know, high quality wood windows. And so it's, you know, part of it is the cost equation. And I wish that I had taken a better opportunity to study this more when I was working there more recently. And then just kind of our planning in general, right? So we have these huge double loaded corridor buildings. They tend to not have very much open space around the building. Their courtyards don't tend to be, you know, usable. And when you look at, and, you know, they'll all be single person units for the most part, like studios or one bedrooms, you know, that's not the typical pattern of development outside of the US and Canada. It's, you know, even on perimeter block buildings, there'll be family sized units. It'll be single loaded corridor or point access blocks. Those are single stair buildings. You know, every unit will tend to have private outdoor space like balconies or loggia. There'll be a massive courtyard. And I think that it just creates this more humane way of living. And I don't know how we kind of synthesize the way that we do development here with the way that they do development everywhere else. But I think that, you know, that is part of how we make these more climate adaptive, more livable cities, because so many of these buildings, they're really just, you know, they're like one generation buildings. And, you know, what happens after that? They're not super flexible. They're not really adaptable. And so there's a lot of questions in my mind around kind of the, you know, are those future proofed?
We obviously have to make a financial case that it's worth building buildings that will last longer than your next, you know, funding cycle. And I'm not sure how you do that if the development model is not adjusted accordingly. You know, I think the short-termism is kind of a big part of the problem here.
Yeah, it really is. Like the keep and hold type development, even here in Seattle, is pretty rare. I would say in, at least in Germany, you know, that was the overwhelming majority of the case. Developers weren't looking at, you know, building a building and then immediately selling it off to some other entity. They were building that building and keeping it kind of in perpetuity, whether they were, you know, a social housing developer, nonprofit, or market rate. And, I think that mentality, it really, you know, it changes the equation a little bit. You know, cities, of course, have more stringent regulations around development that kind of forces a little bit of the difference as well. But I really think it's the financing is the biggest question. And as long as our developable sites, you know, have a really high FAR and don't have, you know, restrictions on building depths like they do in other places, that we're just going to continue to see kind of the same old status quo.
I want to jump back in, Mike. I mean, one question I have is you know, so going back to your Baugruppe and materials discussion aside, I'm curious, like, in terms of, like, now that you've gone through that process yourself, how much of that is replicable and repeatable and can be modeled out there? And I ask partly because I was fortunate. I don't know if you know Jeremy McLeod of Nightingale Housing out of Australia, which has, you know, done a lot of work to create a sort of, like, a branded quasi-scalable process to build, like, you know, passive house, you know, affordable housing in Melbourne. A really great example for listeners. And maybe we'll get Jeremy on here sometime because he's really inspiring. He was here with his partner and they were just, like, touring cities around the world. So I showed him around the net zero building here at here on Roosevelt Island. But anyway, Mike, I was curious, like, you know, like, how much of this, now that you've done an American style Baugruppe, how much of it can you take and recycle it, so to speak, for others, or can they borrow that? I'm just sort of curious from your experience.
So I think that, I mean, the Nightingale discussion is really funny because when Aaron and I were talking about this a couple of years ago, we basically came up with this whole thing, and then we found Nightingale, and we're like, oh my God, it's the exact same thing. So I think that it is going to be scalable. I think it, or at least repeatable. We could definitely repeat it here in Seattle. I think once we have that first thing, that first demonstration. But I really feel like in the U.S. we're so reticent to do anything different, right? Like, it's taken a long time for Passive House to take off. Honestly, it's taken a long time for Mass Timber to take off. I was talking about it way back in 2009, 2010. We're really slow to kind of adapt and change the way that we do things here. And I think part of it is we need a good model to show to people, right? And so until there was a Passive House built in the U.S. in Urbana, like, nobody was really going to do it. And we needed that first, you know, that first kind of step for people, or first model for people to see and say, oh, that is good. That is better. And so we're kind of viewing, you know, our Baugruppe as kind of a build test case for this, right? And, you know, hopefully it is something that people look at and say, look, this is way better than what the market can provide. It's climate adaptive. It's more affordable. It's hopefully more beautiful. Let's do that. And, you know, the hope is that we can get more people on board to do, you know, Baugruppe in here in Seattle or even in other locations. You know, when I first started talking about this a long time ago, the hope wasn't that, like, I would do all the Baugruppe, right? It's really about just, I want people to understand and seek out other models of development, other models of living that aren't necessarily focused on, you know, this hyper-capitalism that we see today, and that they can have better outcomes and produce more livable places. So, you know, my goal is that, you know, with that demonstration project, it becomes easier. We'll see if that plays out, though.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask. I mean, you know, we've talked about this before, and you've been pessimistic about just been pessimistic just now about the general shape of things in American construction. I'm curious, big picture, how do you feel about the recent developments out of California, where the state legislature and the governor have finally passed, like, some really sweeping changes in regulation, like abolishing parking minimums around transit and some of the regulatory red tape that will actually allow us to build slightly more European-ish. Are you feeling, like, a little more hopeful at the moment, or?
For California, I think yes. It'll be interesting to see if cities come back in and, like, try to layer on different regulations to stifle that. Kind of like with single family zoning, right? Cities would introduce bigger setbacks or density limits or other things to kind of, you know, prevent more housing from being added. I definitely think that it's really interesting to see. The no parking is a huge one. I'm not so big on the corridor upzoning. Streets in the U.S., our multifamily housing in the U.S. is already tending to be focused on arterials and corridors, right? They're polluted, they're loud, they're dangerous. We really should be, I think, zoning several blocks, maybe even a quarter mile off of these kinds of streets to make more walkable neighborhoods and to allow people to live, you know, near that arterial, but not necessarily directly on it. So I'm interested to see if that they'll say, hey, look, this is working, but we need to kind of broaden this for environmental reasons or public health reasons. So let's do it. You know, here in Seattle, we don't even have a missing middle legislation that's failed in the last several rounds at our legislature. And so I have a little bit of hope. I think, you know, again, thinking back to the missing middle too, like, it's not really scalable. It's these small projects. They're intersprinkled My previous podcast episode was on the issue of, we don't really have a missing middle problem. We have a missing mid-rise problem, and we should be developing more mid-rise buildings. Oh, by the way, they're kind of the super fruit of urbanism anyway, right? They make more walkable neighborhoods, get more housing, get more affordable housing. It makes it easier to do things like passive house and mass timber. So, you know, it will be interesting to see what comes out of California. So many other places are so far behind. And frankly, without, I think, more help from the federal level, we're not going to see enough movement on cities that do have shortages, like the Boise's or like the Seattle.
I was thinking to mention Minneapolis, too, because they had sort of single-handedly abolished the single-family home requirement on much of their deeper residential streets. But I can't remember what came of that. I think there was some pushback against the Minneapolis attempt to upzone their deeper residential blocks.
Yeah, didn't that get taken to court for an, you know, violation of some SEPA or SECA type statute? I think it was on hold.
Yeah, we'll have to dig deeper into that one offline on this one. But yeah, I say Minneapolis is, and I mean the Twin Cities, both of them really went from being incredibly hopeful examples to cautionary tales. I mean, obviously what happened was St. Paul's rent control, where there was a capital strike before it even took effect. And everyone's like, see, this is why rent control can't work. And then they apparently have abolished that. So that was a disappointing outcome all around there as well. So no great answers in the Twin Cities. Well, Mike, I'm curious also, like, how's the fire season going there? You know, we last did a podcast together about a year ago, and things were burning there. How's it been for you this time around? And yeah, I'm curious, like, the sort of general tenor there, because I think, as we've discussed in the past, and for the education of our listeners now, like, you know, under a lot of climate models, the Pacific Northwest is supposed to be one of the beneficiaries of this when it comes to temperature change and rainfall. But given what happens during the last couple fire seasons, it starts to raise questions about how long will people want to, like, live indoors with HEPA filtration, you know, if the air quality is so poor. So how well are you breathing these days?
So it hasn't been too bad this summer. I mean, last summer was really bad. The heat dome definitely kind of kickstarted a really bad wildfire season. There have been a couple of fires locally that have affected us. The air quality has, it's been to the point where we've had to, like, shut all of our windows, and we have a Corsi Rosenthal box. This is basically just a box fan with filters around it to filter out all of the smoke that does come into our home. We've only had to bust that out once or twice, which is good. You know, for longer treks, you know, we don't have a car, so we have to bike everywhere. There have been instances, like I have to go get groceries, and that's a couple miles, where the smoke has been noticeable and it has been irritating, but it hasn't been to the point where, you know, what was it, last year or 2 years ago, you know, the skies were orange, right? And it was just like everyone came to the realization that Seattle and the Pacific Northwest aren't as protected against the effects of climate change as we all thought they were. I think people are starting to realize that to more of a degree as the western slope of the Cascade Mountains, which are loaded with trees, start to burn. And that's where two of the more recent fires have been. I think that our wildfires here are going to get worse. So long term, I mean, I think that we should be thinking about, you know, passive house as a baseline. But that's a really good question. Like, if the summer is just a season of wildfire smoke, like, how long can people put up with that? I'm not quite sure. The thought of moving to someplace else doesn't really necessarily appeal to me either. You know, heat domes or heat events will exist there, and then a lot of those places are already humid too. And, you know, one of the things I love about here in the Pacific Northwest is that we don't really get a lot of humidity outside of our rain. You know, hurricanes, it really feels like no place is safe. And so really the only strategy is to stop emitting so many fossil fuels.
I actually want to return to the name of your firm for a second, because we did talk about several different types of timber construction. I don't know too much about the larch. Can you tell us about the larch, and are you actually committed to using that in all of your works, or is it just kind of a conceptual hook?
You know, I hadn't really thought of it, using it in every project. It's more of a conceptual aspect. When I was working in Europe, in Germany in 2003, 2004, every project that office worked on utilized larch in some degree, either in the facade or in the windows. Larch is a wood that is, it's kind of bug resistant. It's rot resistant. It weathers to like this really beautiful gray. You know, Peter Zumthor is the renowned Swiss architect, uses it pretty extensively. It's the species here in the U.S., Western larch, it's a little bit different than the Siberian larch, but the properties are similar. You know, I love this tree because it's like the only evergreen tree that changes color, right? If you go out in the fall, and I was just talking about taking my kids out to see these changes locally, you know, you have these green fields and then like these giant splashes of yellow and kind of this, you know, muted orange from the larch tree. You know, it is something that we would like to use in projects. There aren't a lot of manufacturers of larch windows here in the US, so that's probably not going to happen. But it, you know, for me, it's more about what larch represents. And for me, it's, you know, again, that connection back to Europe. It's about that durability and resiliency and also kind of an aesthetic vibrancy and beauty around it.
So I have one last question for you, unless more occur to Dan, which is, Mike, I obviously started this off with discussion, like, you know, I, again, like many others, love like your endless ability to find like the most inspiring European project. What's the current state of the art, like of like perfect timber, Baugruppen, passive house? Like, I'm curious, like, who, you know, if you could talk a bit for our listeners, like who your inspiration is in this. I love hanging out with the circle with like around Kate Wagner on Twitter, where like we show like, you know, people just throw up like Peter, I think it's Peter Barber, the British social housing architect, like those gorgeous brick ones where like, I don't understand how anybody could be resistant to building more of that. But I'm curious, like, yeah, who's your North Star? Like, what's your North Star project of like more of this, please, right now?
That's a good question. You know, there are a couple of Baugruppen projects in Vienna that I think really elevate kind of the entire game around development and decarbonized construction. I'll talk about one. It's Gleis 21. It's a, I think, a 5 or 6 story Baugruppe in Vienna's Sonnenwendviertel. Sonnenwendviertel is this relatively new eco district. It was a former rail yard, and now it's this huge development centered around a massive park. There's housing for, I think, 13,000 people. There's space for 20,000 jobs, schools, daycare, gastro, cafes. Like all of the things you really need are kind of self-contained in this one neighborhood. And then it's connected by transit to everything else, or foot or whatnot. This development is kind of in the heart of it. It's a mass timber, prefabricated mass timber building. It meets passive house. It has a ton of amenities. And the amenities in Vienna, Baugruppen, tend to be even kind of more enthralling and jealousy-inducing than probably other places like Berlin or Munich. It has a huge community room that the wider community is able to use, and they do, you know, music events and stuff in there. There's a massive bike room, which, you know, as a cyclist, just wish that we could do here in the U.S. more often. The rooftop has a roof deck that's got a garden, it's got a communal kitchen, it's got a library, and it has a sauna. And like, how the hell do you get a sauna in social housing in Vienna? And we can't even get it on market rate housing almost anywhere in the U.S. Just blows my mind. The building is designed to be affordable, multi-generational. It's a single loaded corridor, and they've kind of widened that corridor. It's set to the exterior, that so all of the units are kind of accessed on this this exterior pathway, and it's designed so that like you run into your neighbors and you can you know, sit off to the side and have coffee with them, catch up with them. Your kids can play on them. You know, it's kind of this really amazing synthesis of all of the things that I have been advocating for pretty much since I came back the first time working in Germany. And to see that it's possible and there's interest in it, and, you know, they're taking those ideas and replicating it elsewhere. It's probably one of the few things in the architecture world that I'm really kind of excited by. And so I hope that we see more things like this, because to me, this is like, these are the kinds of projects that we should be doing. And it's not just the Gleis 21. It's not just that it's a Baugruppe, or that it's mass timber, or that it needs passive house, but it's also the synthesis of that eco district, right? Like how do we develop our cities to be more climate adaptive, more humane, more family friendly, you know, accessible. And it's not a perfect model. Like, it definitely has issues, you know, looking back as an urbanist, architect, urban planner, like, I don't understand why they did some things. But if you take that and you were to put that anywhere in the US, it would be so transformational. I don't know that we would ever go back to the other way of doing things. So maybe I just need to find like a social impact investor who wants to do these, you know, wondrous, decarbonized, livable eco districts to kickstart that. But I would say that, you know, by and large, that's not the typical form of development. But that specific project at Gleis 21 is phenomenal, and I can send you a link if you guys are doing episode notes.
Indeed, we do. They're often more extensive than they need to be. But I am just so delighted to hear about this this project and about the project you're attempting here in the United States. It's a brave new world. It's a green new world. We have no choice but to do so. So I really want to thank you for joining us today. Michael Eliason from Larch Lab and the Livable Low Carbon City LLC podcast. He's three episodes in. Give him a listen. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thank you.